Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. We have the author of The Bipolar Therapist. Wait till you hear about this book. It's A Journey from Madness to Love and Meaning, a memoir by Marsha Naomi Berger. And Marsha is an author and a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist. Welcome, Marsha.
Thank you, Hillary. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I feel like, see, because I've read your book, I feel like I know you. Do you know what I mean? You don't know me, but I feel like I know you.
I do know what you mean. I've heard this from other people too. Yeah.
Yes. All right. So let's see. Most of the book, I would recommend it. I would recommend it for anybody who's struggling with mental illness or bipolar disorder or anything, anybody who feels like maybe something isn't right. Marsha so courageously tells her story, right? And I do have some questions about that, if that was hard. But So Marsha, it's all started at the anger seminar, right?
You could say that it started at the anger workshop, yes. The book starts with it.
Yeah, the book starts with that, right. The book starts with that. Marsha did an anger workshop where she volunteered to be the guinea pig, right? And ended up getting very angry. Do you think that's what triggered your, I'll just call, can I call them problems? I don't know, your episodes?
It may have had a role. There's no way to prove it. But the anger workshop did happen a few days before my first manic episode, which led to my first hospitalization.
And had you ever had any more? I mean, any before that?
No, I had never had any kind of issue before that. I was a very respected clinician, therapist, working at an alcoholism treatment center. I had become a specialist working with couples and families, which is still a specialty of mine in my private practice, doing therapy and counseling for marriage and other relationships. And this was my first episode. It was big surprise to everybody, I would say.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to give away the book, but I'm going to ask you questions anyway. So when you...
It can be hard not to give it away because people are curious. Well, what happened next?
Yeah, exactly. So, well, I'll just say Marsha went to an anger management workshop. And then how many days later did you go? You went east. She was in California. She went east to her sister's wedding, right?
Right.
You hadn't slept in many days.
Several days, right.
And then all of a sudden had what you'd call an outburst or a manic episode. And the next thing you knew, you were in a... what, hospital?
A good hospital. Horrible, horrible place.
Yeah. Yeah. So she missed her sister's wedding. Did your sister ever, I was wondering, like, did your sister ever, obviously she forgave you, but was she upset about it? I mean, what were people thinking? Do you know? Like what they were.
She never told me that she was upset when I did give her a nice wedding present when she visited me in the rehab hospital, which was a very nice place after the horrible hospital. I don't have to go into details. When you read The Bipolar Therapist, you get the whole sordid picture of the first hospital and then how nice the next place was. It's hard to imagine really what it was like for these other people when I was basically out of my mind.
Well,
probably very frightening for, you know, especially for my mother, since I was staying at her house, and a lot of my craziness, the kind that landed me in the hospital, had to do with how I was relating to her.
So you had never been that way before to her? You had never been angry?
It's very normal on the surface, at least.
Yeah.
If anything, maybe I was on the introverted side at all. You know, when you're manic, you're really out there. You express yourself.
Right. But, like, I would have thought, because you kept saying in the book that you hadn't slept in 5 days or whatever. That in and of itself would make someone manic, you know, but it didn't seem like any of those doctors were picking up on that you weren't sleeping. Do you know what I mean? Like, isn't that a sign of, I don't know, I'm not a doctor and I don't work with people, but of the manic, you know, you're up and you're down. Isn't that a sign that they could have noticed?
Not sleeping for several days is definitely a sign of mania. Yes.
Yeah. But it didn't seem like anybody.
However, this is the first time it happened. You know, it was the first time. And I was not given any diagnosis that I know of during my first hospitalization or in the rehab place. So they tried some different medications, but it wasn't until my second hospitalization that I was given a diagnosis, which I did not believe, because I thought everything was about stress, and that was why I was getting hospitalized. But by the time I got hospitalized a third time, I was really fortunate. I had a kind psychiatrist in the hospital who was urging me to take medication. And I had some dear friends who visited and talked to the psychiatrist, who then urged me to take the medication. And then that changed everything.
And was that when you were taking the lithium?
Yes, that was when I started on the lithium.
And how long did you take that for?
I'm trying to do this without spoiling it for people
who
read the book. Let's say I took it for at least, I started taking it when I was, I think, about 31. And I was still taking it when I was past 40. I stayed on it pretty consistently, you know. Yeah.
But then, and we can blank this out. We can do a spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. After that, you didn't need it anymore, right? And you never had any more episodes.
Oh, you finished the book. Okay. So
I know, but we can cut that out. I just have to ask.
When I talk about my book and people ask me questions like this, I say, I'm going to answer it, but pretend you never heard this.
Right. So BJ, cut this part out. But I just want to ask, so I know, was it just that confined period and then you were fine? And we can cut this part out, just so I know.
There's a common belief.
So you went east. I'm just recouping this. You went east for your sister's wedding, ended up in a very bad place, then got into a good place. Then they released you and you went back to California, right? And you went back to your job and everything was fine until it wasn't, right? And then you got hospitalized, as you said, a second time.
Right.
I'll just say, well, you have to read the book to find out. But when you went to the office that one day and people that you worked with knew something was off, right? But you thought you were fine, right?
Are you talking about after the first hospitalization when I first went back to work?
Yeah, when you went.
I thought I was fine. People may have looked at me a little funny when I was crocheting during a staff meeting, but basically maybe I was less inhibited than I had been before. And I thought it was fine because when I was in graduate school, the University of Michigan, and I had a field placement, and a female, well, at least one female staff member. You know, back then it was okay in that place in that time to be crocheting or knitting during a staff meeting. But it wasn't right. The norm where I was working in California in 1971 or two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was referring to when you went to work in your nightgown and hadn't brushed your hair. And they were like, Marsha, are you okay? And you're like, yeah, I'm fine. And you went and had clients. And
I went to work in my nightgown.
No, I mean, that's what I was just reading.
But I might not have brushed my hair, but maybe I did. I don't remember writing about that or remembering it, but that's funny.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, I was like, oh my God. So anyway, well, I could find it.
No, I really don't think I went to work in my nightgown, but it was worse than that, really, what I did at work for before my second hospitalization. It was worse than going to work in my nightgown. So it's... almost innocent if that was what I had done. But no, what I did was I was feeling just very elated and extremely generous. So I started giving out gifts to different people, my colleagues who I was appreciating very much. and again, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but it's very interesting when you read the bipolar therapist to actually feel like you're there when it is happening and how people are responding to you.
I felt like
experience. You really can feel it when you're reading it. I think you feel like you're going through.
Like I was like, oh my God, don't do it. Don't do it. You know, like I wanted to tell you, you know, don't, you know, but you can't because it's already written and it's already done, but
it's happened.
How did you remember it to write about it? You know, like how many years later did you write about it?
I did write about it a lot later. And somebody just asked me yesterday, somebody I know who was in the middle of reading the book, and he said, how do you remember these details? And I think this is like my speculation. I think it's because I'm a therapist. I may not remember a lot about what's going on in world affairs or in the history of this country or some other country. Or what's in style that people wear now or 20 years ago. However, I remember conversations and I remember interpersonal relationships and how, you know, I think it goes with my being a social worker and a therapist. This is where my head is. And I think that had something to do with why I can remember it so well. And plus some of the things that happened were so outrageous that they might stick in anybody's memory.
Yeah. Well, you know, because probably all of us have fear, you know, like I always think, oh my God, maybe I'm crazy. You know, like there's always that thought, you know, if I'm doing something that's, you know, getting real, this is real, you know, it's out of my constructed personality of being a good girl and people pleasing and stuff like that. So if I say something that's not like the good girl, you know, it's like, uh-oh, are they going to think I'm crazy? Right. So there's always that thought, you know, when you were doing some of the stuff you were doing, now, obviously you were in the manic episode. It's just what you were doing. But I was like, you know, I was getting like, don't, you know, like I was afraid people would think you were crazy. Yeah. So I was wondering if you ever had those thoughts. I mean, I think you did because you wrote about it, but like of people judging you or of people thinking something different than they did before.
I was definitely treated terribly by some colleagues. Who had respected, or I don't know if they had been very respectful to me before in general. I had really basically made a name for myself and I was accepted as a good therapist and people were asking me to supervise them clinically. And I did, and you know, for some people, especially around working with couples and families and also the intake worker and people who, as I said, you know, as an example, okay, example. One of the people I supervised clinically was a former minister and he and his wife had just adopted a baby. And so we're having our supervisory session, and he says to me, what if a supervisee wants to sleep with his supervisor? And I was, he never would have talked to me that before, you know. And I, and I was so taken aback. I said something like, what about your wife? You know, I mean, it had nothing to do really with his wife, but, you know, oh, and he said, well, she got what she wanted, meaning adopted the baby. Yeah, yeah. So totally inappropriate behavior, crossing boundary, verging on sexual harassment, way before the Me Too movement. So right. I couldn't have done anything about it. If I had complained to somebody, it would, you know, it would have backfired on me, if anything. And there were other similar kind of, not quite the same, but things verging on that. And so I was an outcast in some people's minds there. But I continued to do my job and my work. And I had a couple of wonderful work friends, colleagues, coworkers, and we would have lunch together. And I also got really great support from my dear friend, Eileen. She's one of the people in my dedication to the bipolar therapist at the very beginning of the book. She's one of the people that I dedicated it to because she was so there for me. She would, I'm working in this toxic environment, which she knew about because I'd tell her, and she would call me. She'd phone me every night to see how things went. And and one time she said to me something, again, I still remember this. She said, there's free floating hostility everywhere and it lands on someone who's vulnerable.
Wow.
Yeah. So things like that put it into perspective, helped me feel, experience some objectivity in my situation, even though it was really a very uncomfortable, toxic work environment. I had a way of somewhat compartmentalizing myself from that and doing my job until I got recruited to work on a psychiatric ward.
So then where did you go?
This was a general hospital, and nobody there knew about my psychiatric history or that I was taking lithium, but I felt like very respected there and actually honored. It was combined with a teaching hospital, and I was granted an honorary clinical faculty appointment at that hospital too, because people were impressed by my work and my teaching psychiatric residents about how to do intake and how to work with couples and families, et cetera.
And how many years were you there?
I was there for about 4 years.
4 years, okay.
And I got kind of tired of it there after a while because it was the same thing over and over. People come in, they get medicated, they go out. Too many people came back because they wouldn't stay on their medication. It was called the revolving door. Mm. And that was really a very good reminder for me to stay on my medication.
Yeah, I remember there was the thing with the salt, when you cut salt out of your diet.
Oh, okay. Let's not talk about that because people will really like reading that part. So
okay, all right.
Whoever's listening, I'm saving that for you. That is something that not many people know about, and you will when you get to that point in the bipolar therapist.
All right. So you got to read the book to find out about all these great stories that I'm like dying to ask Marcia about, but I'm trying not to blow the story.
No,
right?
Hillary, you just read the book, so I understand that you want to talk about the whole thing.
Yes, I know. Maybe I shouldn't have read the book. But anyway, well,
I love it that you read the book.
Yeah. And it's really,
everybody who reads this book will have a much better understanding and perspective because they're learning, one, it can happen to anybody. Two, we're all human beings. We're not just a diagnosis, and we have various complexities in our life and multifaceted personalities, which the book goes way beyond the diagnosis. You know that, Hillary, because you've read about some interesting relationships I've had with men and with family members. and I think a lot of people relate to that, because whether you have a diagnosis or not, you have various, if you've been around single for a while, you have some romantic relationships if you're interested in them, and you also, everybody's got family and everybody has stuff with their family, and good stuff and also stuff that's challenging and can help us grow.
Right. All right. Now, are we allowed to talk about?
Oh no! Now I'm the cop.
No. If we are, then good. And if not, then
okay. I'll tell you. Right? All right. Okay.
So, I had read another book about that period of time with your grandmother and mother. That, you know, kids, especially Jewish kids, were taken to this orphanage, but they didn't call it the orphanage, right? In your book, you call it the academy. Now, if you don't want to talk about that, that's fine.
No, I love to talk about that. That's fine.
Okay. Because that, it seems like, and I don't know if, you know, that there were a lot of kids who ended up, I don't know what the percentage is, in that place because their parents couldn't take care of them back then. I don't know how, you know, often that was, but
I mean,
it was really, yeah, I mean.
This was the time, can I interrupt?
Callie. Yes, please.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm done.
Okay. In the early 20th century, many, many, many people, many Jewish people, I think other nationalities or religions also, but the knowledge I have is about how so many Jewish people were escaping the kind of bad treatment Jewish people had living in different places in Europe or former Soviet Union, where their prospects were very limited for employment, and there was also a lot of discrimination and God forbid, pogroms, horrible things. And so it became common to, if they could escape that, go to America, the golden land where anything is possible. And so my maternal grandmother was one of those people who came. And my maternal grandfather, who I never met, they ended up getting married and having two children. And as happened in a lot of families, it wasn't so easy to survive and make a living in America. They lived in tenements and, you know, very crowded, and there was disease, and employment prospects were not as great maybe as they had hoped. And it was not so unusual for fathers to abandon their wives and children. And that's why so many ended up in this Jewish orphanage, which was actually, like a prize to be in this orphanage. It was such a good orphanage. And they even calling it the academy, it's the idea that this was a special place where people could learn and thrive. And it was. And there are people who were mentors. My mother had mentors through the orphanage that arranged for her to have a college scholarship, and it turned out really, it was a very good life. I mean, it doesn't make up for not having a parent around right. All the time. The reason my mother ended up in the orphanage was that her mother, who didn't speak English and now had, she was abandoned when pregnant with my mother. She already had a 4-year-old daughter, and she couldn't manage, and she ended up getting hospitalized. And, you know, how much of it was circumstantial and how much of it was mental illness, we don't know. However, her two kids were in the orphanage, you know, from very young age.
So the other one was Sally?
Yes, Sally.
Sally was in the orphanage too.
Yes.
So if your grandmother was pregnant, did she have the baby in the hospital and then they took the baby to the orphanage?
No, she had the baby. I think for, my mother, bless her memory, she may have been 4 months old when she went to the orphanage.
Wow. Yeah. But I remember there was one part where she said, that she found out she had a sister.
Yes. And I can still remember, you know, when you talk about how do you remember things, I remember my mother's happiness and the way she described having learned that she had a sister, that Aunt Sally, I don't know, you know, she might have been 5 or 6 years old, whatever age, you know, she was with the big kids and the little kids were on the other side of some fence where they played in probably a big yard. And Aunt Sally, little Aunt Sally at that time, threw, I believe it was an orange over the fence and said, "I'm your sister."
Wow. Can you imagine? I can't imagine. I mean, you don't have your parents, you know, you don't have parents, but I guess you have people looking out for you, right? It seemed like they were very well funded, those places, right?
I think this one was, yeah.
Which is
Yeah. And I do, there is some material in the book about that and about two of her mentors that were associated with the orphanage. One of them, I think, was one of the trustees of the orphanage and very successful businessman.
Wow. And your mother liked to dance, right? Isn't that what she
enjoyed? My mother loved to dance and she ended up do I give it all away? No, I think that's enough. She loved to dance.
Okay,
and she was
right.
Also very, very good at gymnastics. Very good at gymnastics.
Okay.
And she ended up making a future that was very good use of her skills and her loves.
And you got to read the book. Got to read the book to find out more. So we're just giving teasers all the way through, right? Okay, good. All right. So, and then Yetta, that was your grandmother, right? She never left that. She never left where she went.
Very sad. Yeah, I'm sad. I've never met her.
Did they ever hear from her husband? Did he? What?
No, that's all right. It's just that I never met her. You know, I feel sad about that. I have a picture
you never
in the book.
Her.
I never met her, but my mother and my Aunt Sally, bless her memory now, visit her. And my cousin Margaret, who is the daughter of Sally, I'm really glad that she sent me some photos. So that's why I have, among other photos, there's a photo of my maternal grandmother, which you probably saw in the book. And she's sitting on a bench.
Oh. So I didn't realize you never met her. Oh, interesting. Okay. All right. So anyway, all right. So basically you have to read Marcia's book to get all the good stuff. And you will, you know, you will not be able to put it down because it's so, you just have to keep going to find out what happens, right? It's fascinating. And And we're almost going to the break, the commercial break. All right, let's go to the commercial break. And then, of course, I have more questions for you. And then we'll talk about more about, you know, what else you're doing and how you help people and, you know, your practice and stuff like that. How's that? Good?
Fine. Great.
Okay. All right. Very good. We're going to take a break for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teacher's plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Welcome back to the Getting Real with Hillary Show, and thank you again to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you'd like to bring experiential social-emotional learning to your classrooms, to your schools, to your teams, your business teams, to your offices, whatever, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a consultation. And then I'm going to promote my books because I can. This is my memoir. It's called The Second Piece of French Toast. If you need some summer reading or winter reading, it's a great story. You could probably read it in one sitting, but you're not allowed to judge me. It's very courageous and it is real. Very real. Okay. I did have to change some names to protect that. Well, would I call them innocent? Whatever. You be the judge. You tell me whether they were innocent or guilty. And then this one, when I wrote the first book, someone had asked me, you know, why didn't you speak up when they were proofing the book? Why didn't you speak up? And I said, well, I didn't know I wasn't. So anyway, this book, Real Talk, is the one you saw on the commercial. This one talks about speaking up. And I was not someone who did because I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony who just wanted everyone to like me. So if you have a trouble speaking up as well, you can go to realtalkwithhillary.com, get the book, and then schedule time to talk to me. And I will help you get braver. And then this book is Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. These are techniques that I kind of discovered for getting from what I called the left side of life, where things didn't look so good, back to the right side, where things were more fun, there was possibility, more excitement, and everything looked a lot better over there. So this book is full of techniques. If you find yourself sometimes, you know, you're just not in a good mood and you can't get out of it, or you don't know how, get this book too. They're all available on Amazon. And now we're going to bring back our lovely author of The Bipolar Therapist, Marsha Naomi Berger. Welcome back.
Okay. Hi. Welcome back.
All right. So one of the things, so basically, I'm not going to ask any more questions about the book because you got to get the book. But I know, Marsha, you also work with, you've written other books and you work with, you help people get married, right? Is that what you're like a marriage specialist? Didn't you tell me that when I first met you?
In my therapy practice, I do specialize in working with couples and also individuals, and so much of it is around relationships.
Right. And when did, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, and so the first book that I wrote was published in 2014, and people are still getting it. It teaches couples how to have a weekly marriage meeting, which keeps the relationship on track and helps couples connect nicely every week, usually. If I had it here, I could pull it out.
And, yeah, go ahead. Is that the one behind you? Oh, okay.
This is the marriage meetings for lasting love, 30 minutes a week to the relationship you've always wanted. So it's a short meeting, and I teach the communication skills that make it work well. Many, they may be similar to some of the ones in your book. You know, I wouldn't be surprised. And then my other book, let's see if I have that one around here.
Is that the one on the wall?
And okay. It's called Marriage Minded, an A to Z dating guide for lasting love. So I go through the alphabet and it's fun. It's fun, easy to read. And every letter has a few entries that are from a half a page to a couple of pages or so. And it covers over 100 topics, everything. Wow. Yeah.
And what inspired you to write these books?
Oh, that's a great question. The first book was because when my husband and I first got married, I was already an expert in couple therapy, marriage counseling. Mm-hmm. But it's different once you get married. You're not objective the way you are when you're working with clients.
Right.
Okay? So, and we're very, very newly married, so we weren't entrenched in any kind of issues. However, one of us saw this little notice in a newspaper saying that there is a class called Time for a Better Marriage or something. That's the name of the book they used in the class. And I was, okay, let's go. So we went and we were the only couple that showed up for the class. And this wonderful teacher who wasn't a therapist, she was actually some kind of public school teacher, and her husband ended up joining her. She still did this class for about 8 weeks, one evening a week. And
Just the two of us.
And they would give themselves as examples of how they learn different things. And they were wonderful. And the one thing we took from the class, of lots of things, there was a few minutes spent on the idea of having a weekly marriage meeting with a very simple four-part agenda. Mm. 2 minutes, it was a page and a half in the book that came with the class. That was the one thing that my husband and I kept doing from the class, consciously doing. And so then eventually I started doing like little classes and workshops about it, writing articles. And so it evolved into the book.
Mm. Wow. Did you ever see that woman again? The one that taught the class?
I don't remember if we ever ran into her again. She, you know, we all lived in the same county, Marin County, California. Yeah. So it's possible that I ran into her somewhere. I don't remember though. Yeah.
Well, obviously it helped you. So yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, because this is the same, we're still doing it. We've been married for 36 years now. And we still have a weekly meeting. We even do it when we're on a vacation. And, you know, some of my clients, I teach how to do it. And they say, oh, well, we were on vacation. You know, so what? You know, but it depends what people want. You know, they can be fine if they want to skip a week.
Yeah. Wow. So you're still doing it after all this time. That's amazing.
Right. Yeah.
And how did you guys meet?
It's quick. It's like, you know, once you get used to it, if you don't have any kind of pressing matters, it could be 20 minutes or even 15 minutes. So it doesn't have to be a big chunk of time.
Yeah. Do you do it the same time every week?
Usually, unless we have something going and then we'll change it.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
We usually do it Thursday night, but you know, maybe we're going to do something Thursday night, one or both of us. So then we might do it Wednesday night or some other time.
Yeah. And how did you meet your husband? Well, they already know you have him. Well, you don't want to tell that part. All right.
There won't be anything to learn. But it's just
forget
so
that.
Boring. It's just boring. I could tell you, but it's like ho-hum, you know. But in the book, it's like.
I always ask people how they met.
I can tell you.
It's up to you. I don't want to make you say anything.
I know. I'll give you the quick version. The quick version. Is that I thought he was much too young for me. So I didn't take him seriously as a future lifelong partner, for sure. But he was easy to be with, which is actually very good advice, I think, for people who want to get married. Be with someone who's easy to be with and you want to have this long-lasting relationship.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. All right.
He is a little younger than me, but he's not the difference than I thought he was. The age difference.
Oh, okay. So anyway, again, to get more details, you need to get the bipolar therapist. So we're just giving them teasers here, right? So, okay.
Yeah.
So you guys got married and you did that. And then, I know, well, again, it's in the book, so.
What else are you going to talk about when you think about it? You could ask about my hobbies or.
Well, I know you used to work in companies, and then when did you switch to having your own private practice? Is that a safe topic?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. This goes beyond the book. Yeah. When the book ends, what am I doing? Oh, okay. Yeah. Now I started a little business towards the end of where the book goes. The book is only like maybe about 15 years or mm-hmm. fewer in my life. And I've gone a lot more years after the book in real life. So I started doing a private practice. I really missed it. I took a break for a while. Before I started my little business, I was executive director of a family service agency. And that was a job that took a lot out of me. So when I left that job, I wanted to do something different. And I started a little business. And I liked my little business, but I also missed the kind of intimacy that happens when you're working with people as a therapist. Hmm. So that was why I went back to it. I really missed it. And the kind of connections that you make and knowing that you're making a difference in a really positive way in people's lives is so gratifying and meaningful.
And what, I mean, you seem like you're such a natural with people, you know, like you seem like you're just really good at that. What do you think has you be such a good therapist or so, you know, like some people I think have the knack and some don't. It seems like it's kind of in for you, right?
Yeah, I think so. You reminded me of your question. Reminds me of one of my colleagues at San Francisco General Hospital, another social worker, said, you know, you can sniff out a good therapist. Mm. I thought, wow. And I think there is something to that. You can tell very quickly if somebody is really, if you can connect with someone. Now, for some people, maybe I'm not the right therapist. You know, it depends on the match. Mm-hmm. But when it's a good match, you do know it, and you have almost like an instant trust and rapport with the person. Mm. How did I get to be that way? I'm thinking about Anne Lamott. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's a very popular author in California, maybe nationally.
And I just heard an interview with her on Tim Ferriss. I think it was a repeat of an old one. Yeah. She was very interesting.
Anyway, I've heard her speak a couple of times. And when she talks about her family, how does she put it? She was something like that she is, she had a different word for it, but she was like the therapist in her family. Like there were all these people that needed some kind of help, and somehow it landed on her. And I think I might have had that role with at least one of my family members. Where I got, I don't know, but you know, it's a hard question to answer. Yeah. What maybe,
just your thing.
Because I do think, you know, some people have told me something like, oh, your use of self is so good. And I'm not aware I'm using myself, but I am, you know, I'm not really still strategic, but I'll intuit when it's maybe time to reveal something about myself, because therapists, I think you want to be careful. You don't want to take over with your life story. But once in a while, a personal example is very, very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I forget what I was going to say, but I had I know about like being able to be yourself, you know, like I think it's important for a patient, you call them patients or clients, that they could be self with you, you know, I had some, I tried therapy, I think, 3 different times. It never went well, but they, like, one would, like, scold me. Don't use that word. Don't do this. Don't do that. And I only went to 3 times with her, but I was like, whoa. But, you know, the thing was that she was, it was when I was wondering about whether to stay married or not. And that's really why I went to her. And she said, you know, so I'd be crying because it was a big deal. We'd been married 20 years, you know, so I was crying. I used up all her tissues. I brought my own box next time. But it was really, it was cathartic. Do you know what I mean? I got to really get a lot of it out. And on the third and last time, she said to me, did you ever consider medication? And I said, why would I consider medication? And she said, so you could be happy. And I said, I'm not here to be happy. I'm here to figure out what to do with my marriage. Do you know what I mean? And then I realized, you know, she had been treating me like a confused victim, which is what I had been being. And so I thanked her and I said, you know what? You've been talking to me like a confused victim because that's how I've been being. Thank you. And I'm not returning because that's exactly what I needed, was to stop being a confused victim. And so it snapped me out of my powerlessness, really. So she really did help me, but not in the way I think she thought she was going to.
You aren't, it didn't sound like you were getting the kind of empathy that.
Right. No, there was no empathy. And there was, like, the way she talked to me, I was like, you know, because I'm like, you know, oh, I must be doing something wrong. But then by the third time, I was like, no, this is not okay, you know. So anyway, so I guess,
Go ahead.
No, you go.
Something that every once in a while I hear something similar for somebody that they tried therapist, but the therapist did something they didn't like, so they quit. And I often will say, well, did you tell the therapist what was bothering you about the therapy? Because that's how you really find out what your therapist is made of. If they can have a discussion about that without being defensive and with being empathic towards you during that kind of discussion, that might turn the therapy around. You could give it a chance that way. But sometimes I think you leave, people may leave prematurely if they don't talk about that. It doesn't mean they shouldn't leave, because it has to feel like a good fit. And if it doesn't, then maybe they could refer you to somebody who's a better fit also.
Yeah. But I, you know what?
You don't trust the person. You don't even want to ask for a referral, you know, if you don't trust them, basically. But you do have options. That's the point I'm saying. You have options besides promptly walking away and then maybe feeling victimized by your therapist.
Right. Yeah, I kind of did, but it snapped me out of it. And so it really did give me what
it was helpful. I think that's very interesting that you were able to get that kind of insight from it.
Yes. And I had done some programs before I'd gotten married, and I could see, you kind of get to see who you are. And that was mine, was being a confused victim. But I had forgotten because it had been a while since I had done it. So it was like, oh yeah, there, I'm doing that again. And I could snap myself out, which is what I learned in the program.
I think a lot of it is if a therapist gives the impression that she or he is comfortable with himself, comfortable inside, they're much more likely to feel comfortable for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody's being judgmental or trying to snap you out of it rather than let you be when you need to be a certain place for a certain time, then that person is not comfortable with some strong feelings, or it may, you know, there's a concept of transference as well as counter transference. And one of the things therapists have to do is notice what they're feeling so that they don't act it out in a way that may not be constructive for the therapy. And if they can stay on top of that, then they can really be there in a whole way for their clients or patients.
Interesting. Yeah, I had another one who I would go in fine, and then I would tell her what was going on with my parents, and she would say, well, aren't you angry? And I was like, no. Anyway, by the end of the time, I was angry. And so anyway, so she wasn't a good one either, because my parents were like, what the hell's going on with you? Because I really wasn't. I wasn't angry. But so anyway, I didn't stick with her that long either. But that was when actually that I had done that program for the first time. It's called the Landmark Forum. I did the program and I saw
the forum.
Yeah.
I think that was an outgrowth of EST.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. I remember hearing about that. Yeah.
And so when I did the forum, that's when I saw, oh, you know, no one told me, but I got to see I was a confused victim. So with that therapist, I went into the forum and I said, you know what? I was a confused victim and you were making me worse. And I said, I'm not coming back. And she goes, you'll be back. Well, anyway, I never went back, but I thought, yeah, she was not nice. So I don't know how I found these people, but those are my.
One of the things that I do recommend for people, and I did this myself. This is also in the book, The Bipolar Therapist. I interviewed five therapists before I picked the one that felt right for me. And I could tell in the first session, the one session, that he was right for me.
All right. So we're just going to wrap it up. And what I know, you know, we want people to buy The Bipolar Therapist, and that you can find it on Amazon, right, Marcia?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you can ask your bookstore, the library. Oh, and bookshop.org is a nice place because they support the independent bookstores.
Bookshop.org. Okay, so bookshop.org. And if you like Marcia's book, she also has the other books. Of course, Marriage Minded, A to Z Dating Guide, and The Marriage Meetings for Lasting Love. So you can also find her other books. And what would you like to leave people with, Marcia?
Because I think probably many people who are watching and listening, if they may have a mental illness, or they may have a family member or friend, someone they're very concerned about who has a mental illness. I like to leave everybody with the idea that everybody is much bigger and more complex than a diagnosis. So look at the whole picture of a person. We all have strengths and gifts that we can contribute to the world. And be glad for the gifts that you have and that your loved ones have, and recognize that it's a big picture and the gifts are part of it, and everybody has strengths and everybody also has challenges. So look at the whole person.
Very nice. Yeah. And for people with an illness,
don't let other people define you by it. If you have a mental illness, do not define yourself by it or let other people define you by it.
Okay. Thank you. I'm writing that down. Do not let other people define you. That's great. And what did you learn from writing your books? Anything that you learned or grew from them?
Probably. I think I probably gained some self-compassion from writing The Bipolar Therapist, because a lot of this I hadn't told anybody about for a long, long time because of the stigma and embarrassment and shame that people laid on me when I was going through this rough time. Even after I was taking the medication, the people that knew about it, that job at the Alcoholism Treatment Center, they did define me by the diagnosis, and it became a shameful thing for me. So I think writing the book, maybe it helped me with the same advice that I'm giving other people, to know that I'm much bigger and more complex than a diagnosis. And I've had a very interesting, meaning life, and I've had love and have love and a lot to be very thankful for. And the other two books, I think I really like sharing my knowledge. I mean, I do believe that one reason I was put on earth is to help people create wonderful marriages and other fulfilling relationships. I also think about other relationships. One of my clients was a mother and daughter who had been estranged, and it was wonderful to work with them over time to help them restore their relationship.
That's wonderful.
So anyway,
thank you.
So it's a lot for the books about marriage. It's it's really feeling like I'm doing what I'm meant to do. And it does feel good to share what I've learned.
Mm. Well, thank you, Marcia, for sharing your life, your courage. I mean, really, it took a lot of courage, I would say, to write this. It really did, given what you had gone through. So thank you for your courage. And thank you what you're giving to people, marriages, people who want to get married, all that. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure to chat with you.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.